The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Cochrane, Judge Shellhas, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Very good. Good morning and welcome to counsel. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. Today's date is June 23, 2020. This case is one of three cases set for oral argument before this panel today. All three cases are being argued through the WebEx video conferencing system. The next case on the calendar is case number A19-1277, State versus Antonio Deshaun Collins. Two judges have previously heard two cases in which their technology was sufficient. Judge Shellhas is participating both by video and audio. Judge Cochran is participating only by audio, but we will not have a video connection with her. But let me just confirm now that Judge Cochran can hear me and that we can hear her.
And thank you.
Okay, thank you, Judge Cochran. Ms. Barrett, perhaps you could just say a few words so that we can ensure that you have both a video and audio connection.
Absolutely. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Mr. Keeler, then, assuming that your connection is working, you may proceed with your argument on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Collins.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stan Keeler. I represent Antonio Collins, who is the appellant in this appeal. Mr. Collins seeks reversal of his conviction for gross misdemeanor possession of a handgun, a pistol, in a motor vehicle without a permit. Mr. Collins seeks reversal principally on two grounds, and I would like to start out the primary ground, at least to begin with, is the juror bias issue.
Mr. Keeler, before you begin, I just want to make sure that you can see the time clock. Do you see that?
I do, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. You may proceed.
So a juror was seated, Mr. C, who stated in three different formulations that he could not be fair in a case involving drugs. The district court had chosen this question to pose to the panel, as well as a question as far as their attitudes toward guns. Now, Mr. Chapin was, Mr. C was not rehabilitated. There was little attempt to rehabilitate him. After flatly stating he could not be fair, the district court simply moved on to the rest of jury selection. I don't think that a clear case of juror bias could really be shown here.
Mr. Keeler, what about the fact that this case was not really a drug case in the sense that there was no allegation of unlawful possession of drugs?
Well, as far as the legal, the charge, the criminal charge that was presented and the legal elements of that charge, this was not a drug case. However, drugs were a prominent feature of this automobile stop and of the background to this relationship between these two officers and this defendant. So there are facts that are technically important in a case and that are triggering facts, facts that may not relate to the legal elements, but that may trigger a bias on the part of the jury. And here the trial court chose to ask this question, whether these jurors could be fair if drugs, if drugs were involved. Of course, the jurors at that point did not know the drug context of this case. However, this was an even more potentially triggering aspect of this case than guns, because as far as guns were concerned, this was merely a status offense. There's no brandishing of a gun. There's no use of a gun. The only offense here was the fact that he did not have a permit. And of course, he had had a permit in the past, but the element of drugs was present throughout the pretrial. And although the state points to what was stated at the trial, what evidence came out of trial, decision whether or not to strike this juror had to be made before the presentation of evidence. And at the Rasmussen hearing, particularly, drugs were frequently mentioned, and the police testified that they smelled marijuana on Mr. Collins as soon as they stopped him. And they even found trace amounts of marijuana in his car.
Keeler, isn't this argument your first argument out of three? Isn't this argument essentially barred by Stufflebean, which is a case of the Supreme Court concerning preservation of an argument of this type?
Stufflebean, of course, is a 1983 case that preceded the enactment of the Rules of Criminal Procedure and the Plain Error Rule. In addition, Stufflebean, which sets out a three-part test, has a second test, which is that actual prejudice must be shown. And that part of the test has been abandoned because now it's recognized that the presence of a biased juror on the serving on the jury is structural error. Even as far as the third element, which is the issue here, which is whether there was appropriate objection made, even as to that, in Stufflebean, there was no actual bias shown. So anything that said at that point with respect to the necessity of objection was dictum, because there wasn't showing of actual bias, which is the first Stufflebean prong.
Counsel, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't the plain error rule adopted before Stufflebean? I thought that was adopted in 1978. I could be wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong.
I have to retract what I said, Your Honor. Yes, you're correct. Stufflebean relies on case law that predates the Rules of Criminal Procedure, which were enacted in 1975. But Stufflebean does not recognize the impact of the plain error rule here, which is that you give...
The court could have applied the plain error rule, but did not in Stufflebean.
The court did not do so, Your Honor. And I argue that that is consistent with the Supreme Court's practice at the time, which was to frequently ignore the plain error standard and cite this rule that ordinarily there must be contemporaneous objection to preserve an issue for appeal.
But as an error-correcting court, aren't we bound by the Supreme Court's precedent in Stufflebean? And in that case, the court said that in an appeal based on juror bias, an appellant must show, and this is the first piece, that the challenged juror was subject to challenge for cause. We don't have that here. So isn't the argument waived?
Your Honor, I believe the juror here was subject to challenge for cause. Of course, no challenge for cause was made by defense counsel. But this court has had opportunity to follow Stufflebean, and in the Gelinas case and the Gillespie case, and it has declined to impose an absolute requirement of contemporaneous objection. And in fact, this court in Gelinas noted that the issue was left open of what if the defense counsel simply fails to make a pass for cause and instead is silent on the issue, which means forfeiture, obviously, and the court declined, because those weren't the facts before it. The court did not hold that forfeiture, which is what occurred here, because defense counsel did not pass the jury for cause, forfeiture was sufficient to fall under Stufflebean and to bar the error, the issue on appeal. Now, I think that there is no question that this juror was biased in the theoretical or hypothetical criminal prosecution that he posited in his answers. And at that time, he didn't even know that this case involved drugs. But he stated an unequivocal bias, and he was not rehabilitated. The court simply passed on as if this had never happened. And this is a case in which the court, as is often the case, the court took control of voir dire from the beginning, and the court itself asked these questions, probing into the ability of these jurors to be fair to the defendant and to the state. And having received these answers, which were practically an open defiance of the court's attempts to ensure a fair jury, the court simply moved on. And we're not saying that the defense counsel was prevented from later striking or moving to strike this juror for cause, but there's simply the court did not inquire whether whether defense counsel was passing the jury for cause or whatever. It simply failed to clarify the issue, and the result is that it admittedly, adamantly biased a juror sat on this jury.
Is there any requirement that the court sua sponte strike a juror? Is there any case law requiring that? I mean, that you're aware of?
There is no case law, excuse me, Your Honor. However, this is an egregious situation in which the juror clearly stated a bias that was irrelevant to this case, and he was not further questioned. And even in Gelinas, this court's prior opinion, the court notes that that court struck seven jurors sua sponte. So it's not like this is an unknown practice, especially if the court is personally interrogating these jurors and is taking on the responsibility of ensuring that probing questions that are asked and any biases are brought out. So we're not saying, Your Honor, that at that point when Mr. C raised his hand, that the court was bound to strike him at that point. But the court did nothing. The court did not call a bench conference. The court did not prompt defense counsel or the prosecutor to ask any further questions. And so the court treated this open expression of bias as if it had never occurred.
Mr. Keeler.
Counsel, go ahead, Judge Johnson.
Well, why don't you go ahead, Judge Cochran? I was about to change the topic.
Counsel, isn't it possible that the court was considering trial strategy by the defendant in not raising a challenge to the juror and didn't want to interfere with the defendant's trial strategy?
That's possible.
I mean, if this juror was so biased, wouldn't you expect defense counsel to raise a challenge?
It's possible, Your Honor, that the counsel was distracted because there were two other jurors who had issues with guns, and those jurors were questioned, at least one of them separately, privately. And it's possible that the counsel just lost track of this juror who had expressed a bias as far as drugs were concerned. But that would be speculative. And we don't need to speculate. It's the court's responsibility, as it ultimately is, the court's responsibility to avoid structural error creeping into a trial.
Thank you.
But isn't it possible, counsel, that this was a trial strategy on the part of defense counsel, because this juror also indicated that he was a member of the National Rifle Association, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Again, as I said earlier, as far as guns were concerned, this was a status offense. He had a pistol in his motor vehicle. It wasn't a case that would elicit any kind of bias or prejudice, strong reactions on the part of the jury as far as guns were concerned. So I don't see a logical strategy to try to enlist a gun supporter on this jury. I'm sorry.
Mr. Keeler, I'd like to hear your argument concerning the third issue, whether there was corroboration of appellant's confession. And I guess I'm interested particularly in the legal standard for how much corroboration is necessary, because it seems to me that we do have one question and answer in the testimony of an officer indicating that the officer checked the appropriate public records and found no registration. And I'm wondering why that's not sufficient.
Well, Your Honor, I think on close inspection of that question and answer, The officer did not state that he had reviewed any records. The prosecutor assumed that in his question and moved on to the second part of the compound question was implicitly asking, do those records show that he did not have a permit? The officer just said, correct, was his answer. But to what to which part of the question was he responding when he said correct?
So let's assume for the moment that let's assume that had been crystal clear, that there had been a question saying, you know, officer so-and-so, did you check the appropriate public records and confirm that he was did not have a permit on that day? And the officers, you know, said yes, perhaps provided narrative explaining what he had done. Would that single question and answer be sufficient corroboration under the statute?
Well, I think counsel could have had a best evidence objection to that.
But assuming admissibility and assuming clarity of the evidence, is that in this type of a case, would that type of testimony, if that was understood by the fact finder, would that be sufficient corroboration of the appellate?
I think that would be sufficient, Your Honor. I just don't see that was actually established. There's no competent evidence on the part of this officer that he had actually reviewed records showing that the defendant did not have a valid permit.
Is there any case law you can point us to that examines whether the degree to which, or let me rephrase that, any case law that supports your argument that their foundation needs to be laid before that testimony can be relied on to corroborate the confession?
No, I don't have specific case law on that point, Your Honor. Some of the case law in this area is homicide cases, obviously, and there's a much more fully developed trial record. But this issue, although the prosecutor admitted it was an element, but he passed over this element entirely except for this single compound question to the officer. If there are no further questions, I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Yes, you will have an opportunity for rebuttal. I have one technological comment, Mr. Keeler. Your audio was somewhat suboptimal. I think it would be You have two connections, it appears. I think it would be best if your second connection was muted for the remainder of the argument.
Yes.
And also, I think would be good, need not be said, but if you could mute your own microphone during Ms. Barrett's argument, that would be
right.
Thank you. Ms. Barrett, on behalf of the state, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Paula Barrett, and I represent the state of Minnesota, city of Minneapolis, and the respondent in this matter. The court is correct when it recognized that there is nothing in the rules or case law that imposes upon a district court a duty to sua sponte, dismiss prospective jurors for cause. In Minnesota, a challenge is necessary to preserve a claim of jury bias. Under the rule itself, under Rule 2602, it says that a challenge for cause must be initiated by motion, and it is the court's role to determine whether or not to sustain such a challenge. The facts in Gillespie are very similar to those here, Your Honors. The court in Gillespie analyzed that case using the plain error standard, which is the standard of review that we have been operating under when representing our clients in this case. In that case, in Gillespie, the court engaged in voir dire regarding the second juror's past jury service and told Gillespie that he could ask any questions he wanted of all of the jurors. In that case, Gillespie didn't question any of the jurors, and the second juror with the past jury experience, and that second juror was impaneled after he passed her for cause. He passed her for cause, and then he did not exercise a peremptory challenge to exclude her from the jury. In Gillespie, the Court of Appeals recognized, they went through an analysis, the first part of which had to do with the court's limited voir dire. And what they said is that even if the court's limited voir dire was in error, the error would not warrant a new trial, and for four reasons. The first of which is that Gillespie failed to object to the court's limited voir dire. And the court posited that a criminal defendant can't stand by and then challenge the process on appeal. The court also recognized that Gillespie did not ask the court to ask more questions of the panel. And then the court did presume that the district court in Gillespie was satisfied with the court's inquiry. The third reason that it would not have warranted a new trial is that Gillespie himself had the opportunity to ask more questions, and yet he did not. And finally, Gillespie had not established that the court's limited voir dire made the trial fundamentally unfair, and recognized that no plain error exists when a defendant does not establish prejudice. Now, they went on to also discuss whether or not the district court had a duty to sua sponte challenge or dismiss jurors for cause, which is exactly what appellant in this appeal is arguing that you tell the district court to do now. The Court of Appeals, in analyzing whether or not there was a duty to sua sponte dismiss jurors for cause, recognized that a challenge for cause must be initiated, because the court's role in these cases is to determine whether or not to sustain the challenge, not to sua sponte strike jurors for cause.
But counsel, isn't the trial judge's overarching duty to make sure that the trial is fair?
Absolutely, Your Honor. That is absolutely but the trial judge also has to respond to appropriate motions being made. They have to determine whether or not a fair trial is being conducted. And in Gillespie, as is true here, in State versus Gillespie, the Court of Appeals, the district court in that case, as it could hear, reasonably inferred from the defendant's failure to object to that juror, that juror was acceptable to the defendant, because it would have been advantageous for him to retain her on that jury because of her disillusionment with lawyers.
Counsel, what about appellant's point that the defense counsel didn't pass the jury for cause?
That is absolutely true. The court did not ask defense counsel to pass the jury overall for cause. What did happen, though, is the defense counsel did actually question jurors in this case, question two other jurors that she felt were actually biased against appellant in this matter. I think it bears to note that during the district court's questioning of juror C in this matter, he did admit that he had a problem with cases that would involve drugs. But he also answered questions that tended to show that he may have been a favorable juror for appellant, including his membership in the NRA. He also testified about his about an accident that had occurred 20 years before. He talked about how law enforcement sought him out as a defendant, and he also even described himself as a victim in that case, even though he was charged as a criminal defendant. And taken all together, even it appears that what happened here is that defense counsel decided not to challenge him for cause, because she thought that it might be advantageous to keep him on the jury, and decided to challenge the other two jurors for cause that had significant opinions regarding guns or gun possession. Defense counsel did question the entire panel. She questioned the whole panel. She questioned both of those other challenge jurors, one outside, you know, one in one before the whole panel and the other in private. And she also did not follow up with Juror C regarding his attitudes about drugs. And it could have been because of trial strategy. I do understand appellant's argument that drugs were part and parcel of this case. The problem with that argument is that they were a peripheral matter, especially before the trial court, until defense counsel.
But given jurors' statements, I have to find the exact language, but it was a pretty strong statement that if drugs were involved, there would be I'll find the exact statement, but in any event, you know, even if they were peripheral, doesn't that statement indicate a bias on the part of Juror C?
Potential. It calls into question whether or not he should have been questioned further regarding his attitudes regarding drugs. Part of the problem that we all have in this case is that we were not in the courtroom at the time. We don't know whether or not defense counsel just decided not to ask those questions in favor of asking questions. Ask those questions as opposed to asking questions about the gun possession. We don't know whether or not appellant consulted with defense counsel and decided that his answers regarding drugs were not important. And
also, in your view, does Stufflebean still controlling, and does that require appellant to challenge the juror for cause in order for
yes,
the court to review the argument?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, it is the state's position in the matter that Stufflebean does still control. Although Stufflebean is a case that is older, State versus Gallineau discussed the fact that Stufflebean still holds water. The appellate court precedent throughout has been that an objection is necessary for appellate relief, even either under the plain error standard of review, or whether or not this was structural error overall. I understand that appellant argues that that allowing this biased juror to sit is actual structural error, but I think what appellant's argument ignores is that under State versus Logan, the issue still needs to be preserved. There still needs to be an objection raised in order for that to reverse it and order a new trial.
I'd like to turn to the third issue,
sure.
The question of whether there's sufficient evidence to corroborate the confession. There really is only one question and answer that I can see that goes to whether, you know, any independent evidence regarding whether he was issued a new permit. And are you aware of any published case where that limited evidence of that is of that limited amount was sufficient to corroborate a confession?
Your Honor, I am not aware that there's any published case specifically indicating that one piece of evidence was sufficient. But I, although inartful in this case, admittedly inartful, the prosecutor's question still elicited testimony from Sergeant Carter that he had reviewed records that he had access to, and he determined that appellant did not have a valid permit to carry a pistol. But
there's
what
no
I
testimony as to what those records are. So how can how can that answer then be sufficient?
The answer does not need to be sufficient, and the reason for that is, even though the prosecutor in this case indicated that it was an element of the crime that the state needed to prove that that appellant did not have a permit to carry, that is actually not the law. Under State versus Timberlake, without a permit language in that statute, does not add another element that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. It implicates an affirmative defense that the defendant must raise, and the defendant must come forth with some evidence of a permit to carry. So even though the state did say that it was an element of the crime, it is not an element of the crime. In this case, the evidence is sufficient to believe that the appellant did not have a permit to carry, because appellant did not raise this affirmative defense. He did not give notice that he was going to raise this affirmative defense. And he also did not provide any testimony that he did have a valid permit to carry when he testified himself. In this case, in conclusion, I see that I'm running out of time. In conclusion, the state is asking for this court to affirm appellant's conviction for gross misdemeanor pistol without a permit. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Barrett. Counsel for appellant, Mr. Keller, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could start with the last issue. Of course, Timberlake involved what the officer needed to know before stopping the defendant or engaging in some other police intrusion. What we have here is proof beyond a reasonable doubt at trial, in which the crim jigs themselves say this is an element that the state needs to prove, that this person lacked a valid permit to carry. So, but as far as the adequacy of the corroboration, you know, I'd just like to say that the prosecutor never cited this testimony by Sergeant Carter in his closing argument. He just treated this element of the lack of a valid permit as a technicality that the state didn't have to prove by any means except by the defendant's confession, which he did cite. But going to the juror bias issue, I think the bottom line here is that having a biased juror sit on the jury is structural error. And if that's the case, how can there not be, at least at some point, at least when a case comes up on appeal and the appellate court is looking at a trial, how can there not be some duty on the part of the court to sua sponte strike a juror who was as clearly biased as this juror was? Even though lesser remedies may have cleared up the problem, you have a juror here who just simply flatly stated his bias in any case involving drugs, and he didn't limit it to a drug possession charge or a drug where drugs were the charged offense. He said, I believe, if I could quote him, "I detest drugs with a passion. I would not be able to be fair if drugs are brought out in this." That he wasn't saying that I can't fairly judge a drug charge, a drug possession or sale charge. Now, the state is indicating that Gillespie...
Counsel, you argue that we should apply the plain error standard. And assuming we were to do that, given that there is no rule or case law that requires a court to sua sponte strike a juror, how would any error be plain? Assuming there was error in not striking this juror.
Well, the error simply would be in allowing the biased juror to sit. I'm not sure that plain error requires an active participation or a decision actively by the judge. But if the court has a sua sponte duty, as it does in other areas, then it is plain error not to do something. And here, the court itself was questioning this juror and allowed this juror's blatant commitment to bias to just stand there. The other jurors certainly must have been aware that this juror had taken this stand. This juror, who was later became the foreperson, had taken this clear stand in front of the judge and had openly stated he could not be fair, and yet there he was sitting amongst them in the jury room. But
Mr. Keeler, if we were to apply the plain error doctrine, what would we do about the third requirement about substantial rights in light of the fact that the right you're asserting, if present, leads to structural error? How do we harmonize those two principles?
Well, I think the substantial right involved here is simply the right to a fair trial, to an unbiased fact finder, and
essentially. So are you saying the third requirement would be automatically satisfied?
Automatically or just by the very nature of jury, the selection and the biased jury, yes. So I'd just like to say that Gillespie is not factually similar to this case because there was an affirmative waiver, a pass for cause. And in this case, there's nothing more than mere silence, which under the case law constitutes forfeiture. It doesn't rise to the level of a waiver. Waiver requires intentional relinquishment of a known right or privilege, and there's no showing of an intentional relinquishment in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keeler. Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute.
The court is now in recess.